Welcome to the deep dive. I'm just so incredibly pumped to have you here with us today.
It's going to be a good one.
It really is, because we know exactly who you are, right? You're the kind of person who is just fiercely curious. Maybe you need to be thoroughly well-informed for a big presentation later this week, or, maybe you just love understanding the actual mechanics of where the world is actually heading.
Yeah, you want to know how the gears turn.
Exactly. But you also don't want to drown in that absolute avalanche of information overload that hits us every single morning. You want the signal.
Right.
You want to skip the noise. And that is exactly what we are going to deliver for you today.
That is the mission. We've spent the morning going through all that noise so you don't have to, pulling together this stack of incredibly fascinating tech briefings from today, March 5, 2026. And I have to say, looking at all these sources laid out together on the desk, the patterns emerging are, they're nothing short of revolutionary. We are looking at a fundamental rewiring of how technology operates.
Okay, let's unpack this, because our overarching theme today is massive. We are looking at a historic tectonic pivot of power. Think about the last decade. Everything, and I mean everything, was moving to the cloud.
Right, the whole everything as a service era.
Exactly. We were constantly told our personal devices would eventually just become dumb glass screens, like thin clients connecting to massive remote server farms where the actual real computing happened.
Yeah.
But based on our sources today, that trend is violently reversing. Power is moving straight back into local on-device hardware.
What's fascinating here is that while these might sound like completely disconnected events across wildly different industries, they all point to one undeniable reality. The era of hardware independence has arrived.
Hardware independence. I love that phrasing.
Yeah, because the common thread running through our sources today is this: if you don't own the actual physical hardware in this new landscape, you are just renting space in the digital world, and renters are always vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely.
You're vulnerable to server outages, government regulations, and just corporate bottlenecks in general.
It's a total paradigm shift. To give you a roadmap of what we're looking at today, we've got AMD's monstrous new laptop chip, the EU's incredibly strict new AI regulations, Tesla's battery breakthroughs.
Huge news there.
Yeah, massive. Plus, Sony's mind-bending PlayStation 6 patents, humanoid robots literally taking over Amazon fulfillment, and a Xiaomi phone that ignores cell towers to talk directly to space.
It's a packed board today.
It is. I want to start with the silicon power play because this really sets the stage. Just 12 hours after Apple announced their M5 Fusion chip, AMD fired back.
They didn't wait around.
No, they did not. I'm looking at the briefing for their Ryzen AI 400 series, codenamed Strix Halo. The specs here look insane, but help me translate this a bit. They are calling it a monolithic die that fuses desktop CPU power with console graphics. What makes this architecture so different?
Well, the engineering choices here are deeply strategic, and obviously a direct shot across Apple's bow. Let's look at the processing cores. AMD is packing in 16 full-fat ZNN6 cores.
Wow.
Now, to understand why that matters, we have to look at the trend they are completely rejecting. For the last few years, the industry standard has been this big little design philosophy.
Right.
That's where you mix a few high-performance cores with a bunch of weaker high-efficiency cores to save battery. AMD is completely throwing that out the window. All 16 of these are maximum performance cores, feeding directly into the software scheduler.
So it's like fielding a soccer team where every single player on the pitch is your star striker. There are no bench warmers just jogging around to save energy.
That's a great way to look at it. But of course, if you have 16 star strikers, you need to be able to pass them the ball incredibly fast.
Right, the data bottleneck.
Exactly. That's where the memory comes in. The briefing notes they built a 256-bit memory controller. To put that in everyday terms, imagine upgrading a standard two-lane local road into a massive 10-lane superhighway. It pushes system memory bandwidth to 273 gigabytes per second. They are practically obliterating the data transfer bottleneck that has always plagued traditional PC architectures.
But wait, if you are throwing that much raw power and data into a laptop chip, what happens to the graphics? Because the briefing claims this chip effectively kills the need for entry-level graphics cards. Like those dedicated NVIDIA cards we see in mid-range gaming laptops. How are they pulling that off without the laptop just, melting your
It
desk?
all comes down to their integrated graphics architecture. They are using their new RDNA 4 setup with 40 compute units.
Farty.
Yeah. And to give you some context on how wild that is, the PlayStation 5 sitting in your living room right now only uses 36 compute units of older tech.
Are you serious?
Yeah, so AMD is putting more graphical muscle directly onto the single laptop chip than a dedicated gaming console has. Because you no longer need a separate, discrete graphics card bolted onto the motherboard, you slash the power consumption and you massively drop the thermal heat.
So it runs cooler.
It runs cooler, it's cheaper to manufacture, and the performance is staggering. The source states it can run massive games, like Cyberpunk 2077, natively, at 1440p high resolutions at a smooth 60 frames per second.
Just natively on a laptop chip. That is wild. But the reason you really need to care about this goes way beyond having a sleek laptop that plays games.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the AI specs here. The briefing mentions an NPU, a neural processing unit, that hits 150 TOPS.
Trillion operations per second.
Right. Compare that to Apple's new M5 Max, which apparently sits at 120 TOPS. What does that 150 TOPS actually let me do?
This is where we get back to that core concept of hardware independence. This absolute edge in AI inferencing means that massive 30 billion parameter large language models, think of systems as smart as the current Llama 3, can run entirely offline.
Just on the device.
It just sits right there in your system memory.
No internet connection required.
None. Imagine you are an international developer or an enterprise worker with strict corporate privacy rules that forbid sending sensitive data to a cloud server.
Right, which is increasingly common.
Very common. Running a massive AI model natively on your lap grants you complete hardware sovereignty. You are completely untethered from the cloud monopolies.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because AMD isn't the only one redefining what local hardware can do. I was reading through these leaked patents filed at the USPTO by Mark Cerny.
The PlayStation architect?
Yeah, the lead architect for PlayStation. These documents give us a look at the beating heart of the upcoming PlayStation 6, and it genuinely sounds like a total departure from how computer graphics have worked for the last 30 years.
It is a fundamental shift.
Yep.
They are moving away from traditional hardware rasterization, which is the old method of calculating every single pixel's lighting and geometry manually, and moving toward entirely neural network-driven rendering.
Okay.
The key component in these patents is a processing block called PSSR 2.0. That stands for PlayStation Spectral Super Resolution.
Okay, I know the PS5 Pro had a version of that, but it basically just upscaled static images to make them look a bit sharper. What does version 2.0 do differently?
Right. The previous version was essentially a really smart Photoshop filter.
Fantastic.
PSSR 2.0 actually predicts internal geometry in real time. According to the architecture diagrams, the console might only render a game natively at a standard 1440p resolution.
Which isn't that high by today's standard.
Exactly. But then, this dedicated machine learning hardware injects complex path-tracing lighting calculations and outputs a pristine, true 8K resolution image. And it does this at 60 frames per second.
The briefing specifically mentions a CPU and GPU unified architecture hooked up to ultra-fast memory pushing 32 gigabits per second. And it claims this completely eradicates texture streaming delays. Does this mean what I think it means for massive open world games?
It means the loading screen is dead.
Finally.
Truly. For massive sprawling games, the bottleneck has always been fetching the art assets from the hard drive and pushing them to the graphics card.
Yeah.
Sony engineered a dedicated cache layer, an L4 cache, that hooks directly into this ultra-fast GDDR7 memory.
Right.
The data moves so fast, and the AI predicts the frames so efficiently that loading screens simply won't exist.
I love the way the gaming analyst in our source materials phrases this. They wrote that the PS6 doesn't just calculate pixels, it hallucinates them. The console is basically daydreaming the game into existence right in front of you.
That phrasing is perfect. The PS6 is fundamentally a packaged AI inferencing machine tailored specifically for gaming. And the analyst makes a great economic point. If a $500 console can use AI to hallucinate 8K graphics flawlessly, the economic justification for a consumer to buy a $3,000 custom-built PC completely evaporates.
So we've got heavy computing moving to laptops and AI hallucinating graphics in our living rooms. Let's take this concept of revolutionary hardware out into the physical world. Let's talk infrastructure.
Let's do it.
We have huge news from Tesla today. Yesterday, the Chinese automaker BYD revealed a new battery that can charge in 5 minutes. Today, Elon Musk countered with Tesla's new 4680 batteries, and the secret weapon seems to be pure silicon anodes.
This is a classic metallurgical battle playing out on a global scale. Traditionally, electric vehicle batteries have used graphite for the anode part of the battery cell. But graphite has a physical limit to how fast it can absorb lithium ions. It's the ultimate bottleneck for fast charging. Tesla is moving to pure silicon anodes, which increases that ion absorption capacity by 10 times.
But I remember reading years ago that silicon was a terrible idea for batteries because it expands when it charges. The briefing even mentions it literally swells up by 300%. How do you stop a car battery from expanding like a water balloon and destroying itself?
That has been the billion-dollar engineering problem for a decade. Tesla engineers resolved this by using what the source calls an elastic polymer matrix.
An elastic matrix?
Yes. Instead of a rigid structure, they essentially built a microscopic, flexible cage inside the battery cell that structurally manages that extreme expansion and contraction without degrading the materials.
And what does that actually mean for someone driving the car?
The real-world impact is a 30% surge in energy density. They are pushing from 260 to 340 watt-hours per kilogram. For the consumer, this means the upcoming Tesla Model Y Juniper Refresh can achieve a 500-mile range, that's about 800 kilometers, with the exact same battery weight as the older models.
But I did notice a catch in the briefing regarding the charging infrastructure. Tesla is capping their charge rates on their superchargers to a sustained 350 kilowatts.
Right.
That's a lot less than the massive 1-megawatt chargers China is deploying for their 5-minute batteries. Why hold back?
This raises an important question about strategic infrastructure. China is betting on massive grid-screening 1-megawatt chargers to slam power into the car as fast as possible. America's strategy, led by this Tesla silicon bet, prioritizes supreme energy density.
So they want longer range between stops instead.
Exactly. And a guaranteed 10-year battery lifespan. Shoving a megawatt of power into a battery degrades it quickly. Tesla is balancing speed with longevity, but the briefing does include a stark warning. This pivot means the old 50 to 100 kilowatt charging networks you see in mall parking lots today are functionally obsolete.
Wow.
If local grids don't upgrade to handle sustained 350 kilowatt infrastructure, they are essentially locking themselves out of the next generation of mobility.
Incredible. Speaking of physical movement in the real world, I was blown away by this Amazon announcement. They're officially moving out of their pilot phase and deploying over 500 fully electric Boston Dynamics Atlas humanoid robots into active fulfillment centers. 500 humanoids.
It is officially the largest commercial deployment of bipedal robotics in logistics history. And the engineering on these new Atlas units is a massive leap forward from what we used to see.
Yeah, I think we all remember those viral videos of the old robots doing parkour, but they sounded like a noisy garbage truck.
Right. Those older generations used very loud, leak-prone hydraulic pumps. This new generation utilizes zero-leakage electric actuators. These are custom rotary motors that give the robot's joints a range of motion that completely defies human anatomy.
The visual described in the briefing is straight out of a horror movie, honestly. It says an Atlas robot can bend down, pick up a 30-kilogram package, and place it on a shelf behind it by simply swiveling its torso completely backward.
It doesn't even move its feet.
If a human warehouse worker tried that, they'd be calling a chiropractor immediately.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Amazon isn't doing this for the sci-fi aesthetics. This is all about ruthless return on investment. According to the financial filings in our sources, the operational and charging cost to run one of these Atlas units is just $4.50 per hour.
Compared to a $22 minimum hourly wage for a human worker in the U.S.
Exactly. Plus, robots have zero sick leave, and they don't file workers' compensation claims for joint wear and tear.
It's a seismic tremor for labor. But how do you orchestrate 500 of these things zipping around a warehouse without them crashing into each other?
That requires localized network infrastructure. The source notes they are building private 5G millimeter wave factory networks. These robots have head-mounted LiDAR, generating massive amounts of 3D mapping data every second.
Oh, so they need huge bandwidth locally.
Exactly. They need incredibly fast localized networks to process that data and coordinate the fleet in real time. The briefing explicitly calls this the dawn of silicon supply chain colonization. Robotics has exited the tech demo stage. The total cost of ownership has now undercut base human labor, and the infrastructure to support it is entirely local to the warehouse.
All right, let's look at the global stage. We're moving into geopolitics and connectivity. Now, before we dive into this next topic regarding the European Union's AI Act and OpenAI, I want to be absolutely perfectly clear with you. We are maintaining strict neutrality here. We are not taking any political sides, left or right, on European regulation versus Silicon Valley innovation. We are simply reporting impartially on the strategic impacts exactly as they are laid out in today's source materials.
That is very important context. So looking strictly at the facts provided in the briefing, OpenAI has officially announced the revocation of reasoning autonomous agents for all users and corporate clients within the European Union. This is the direct fallout of the EU AI Act entering its final strict enforcement phase. The law now classifies any foundation model with computational power exceeding 10 to the power of 25 flops as a high-risk system.
Okay, let's translate that threshold. 10 to the power of 25 flops basically means if an AI agent is smart enough to execute complex autonomous actions like researching a company, writing software code, debugging it, and executing it on a live server entirely by itself, the EU steps in.
Correct.
They require that the AI be instantly audible by regulators, and its error tolerance has to be certified by compliance agencies.
And the stakes for noncompliance are severe. The penalty for violating these regulations is 7% of a company's global revenue.
7%. That is massive.
For a company like OpenAI, which is valued at over $200 billion, a single violation could mean fines in the tens of billions. Their business decision, based purely on this financial risk, has been to completely brick these autonomous agent capabilities in Europe.
So they're stripping the functionality down and only leaving basic, heavily sandboxed chat models online for EU users.
Exactly.
So OpenAI's smartest agents are essentially banned in Europe. I imagine that creates a massive gap in the market. How is the industry responding to this?
This is where the source text provides a really fascinating geopolitical insight. When stringent legislation pushes out advanced proprietary models, it creates a massive vacuum. And that vacuum is being eagerly filled by open source insurgents.
Like who?
Entities like Meta and France's own AI darling, Mistral, are deploying open weight models rapidly.
But how do open weight models get around the strict audit rules that made OpenAI leave?
It's not that they get around the rules. It's that their architecture inherently complies with them much easier. Because the foundational weights of an open source model are publicly accessible, they offer the instant auditability the EU requires.
I see.
A proprietary company like OpenAI relies on their model being a black box. They can't open it up for audit without exposing their trade secrets. The strategic takeaway from the briefing is that this heavy-handed regulation designed to control AI is actually accelerating the adoption of decentralized open source development.
So the market just routes around the obstacle.
Yes. Europe is essentially building a regulatory glass wall around itself. Inside that wall, open source is thriving. But outside that wall, Silicon Valley's unconstrained autonomous agents continue to automate the global South and North American markets at breakneck speeds.
So what does this all mean for the future of global communication? If regions are putting up digital glass walls, how do we actually stay connected? That brings us to our final piece of the puzzle, Xiaomi's global launch of the 16 Ultra smartphone. If Europe is building a regulatory wall, Xiaomi just handed everyone the hardware to completely jump over it.
This device is a true paradigm shift for global connectivity. The Xiaomi 16 Ultra is the first commercial smartphone capable of bilateral satellite video calling.
And we aren't just talking about the basic emergency text-only SOS features we've seen on recent phones.
Not at all. This phone establishes a stable 5 megabits per second bandwidth link directly to low Earth orbit satellites.
And the hardware making that happen is wild. It uses a miniaturized phased array antenna. Now, normally to talk to a satellite, you need a dish that physically moves to point at the sky.
Right.
A phased array antenna steers the radio signals electronically. It has zero moving parts, but it can dynamically track and lock onto moving satellites in orbit while the phone is just sitting flat in your hand.
It's an incredible feat of miniaturization.
And just as a quick aside on the hardware, the camera tech on this phone is equally crazy. It uses liquid lens mechanics. Basically, they apply electrical currents to a tiny droplet of oil and water, and the lens changes its curvature in milliseconds. It shifts optical zoom from 3x to 10x instantly, mimicking the biological speed of a human eye.
It's brilliant engineering.
But getting back to that satellite connectivity, why is a 5 megabit connection to space such a big deal?
Because it completely bypasses terrestrial infrastructure. It bypasses local cell phone towers. It bypasses software VPNs. You could be standing in the middle of the Sahara Desert or sitting in a city experiencing a total blackout of the local power grid or living under strict local internet censorship, and you can still transmit end-to-end encrypted high-definition video straight to space.
The briefing summarizes it perfectly. It says Xiaomi didn't just build a new phone. They distributed an independent secure transmission node. The future of internet freedom isn't going to be fought with software. It's a hardware war against local infrastructure constraints.
And that brings us perfectly to the synthesis of everything we've unpacked today. The architect's verdict from our sources paints a definitive, cohesive picture. Absolute power is consolidating back into local, on-device hardware.
Full circle.
Exactly. AMD is pulling heavy AI computation out of the remote cloud and putting it directly on your lap. Sony and Boston Dynamics are proving that physical reality and virtual worlds can be rendered, mapped, and navigated locally with incredible efficiency. And devices from Tesla and Xiaomi are completely bypassing local power grids and terrestrial internet monopolies.
The urgency and dependency on remote cloud infrastructure are dying.
The era of hardware independence is truly here.
Wow. It really comes down to that single idea. If you lack the hardware, you are merely a tenant in the digital domain. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over today, building on everything we've just uncovered.
Let's hear it.
If our phones can now talk securely and directly to space, and our laptops can run massive, genius-level AI models completely offline without needing the cloud, what happens when all these hyper-powerful devices start talking directly to each other? Could the future of the internet be an invisible, decentralized mesh network made entirely of the devices sitting in our pockets, completely outside the view of any traditional internet provider or global kill switch? Something for you to chew on today. Stay curious, keep questioning the world around you, and we will catch you next time.